Chapter 17. Suspicious from day one that there was more to the JFK assassination than met the eye, especially after Jack Ruby shot Oswald, Dorothy Kilgallen, throughout the trial, must have awakened with her brain buzzing about what she had watched and heard in the Ruby courtroom. Each evening, it stands to reason that she would have collected her notes, organized them, and after dinner and a vodka and tonic or two, attempted to digest the importance of the testimony from eyewitnesses to history. If she was looking for a bombshell moment that would escalate her belief that Ruby had been ordered to kill Oswald, it came out of the blue from, of all people, a parking lot general manager. When Kilgallen later checked her notes regarding testimony on this day, it is reasonable to assume she circled Mr. Hallmark's testimony as arguably the most significant regarding Jack Ruby's strategy for assassinating Lee Harvey Oswald. First, the testimony that Ruby was making like a reporter and was writing on a piece of paper, the former from the testimony of John Rutledge of the Dallas Morning News and the latter from Detective T.B. Leonard, as noted, confirmed what Kilgallen had to have suspected, that Ruby's ruse to make it look like he was a reporter and gain access whenever and wherever he chose was indeed a reality. Whether he had thought of the ruse himself, or whether others in concert with his plan to assassinate Oswald suggested it, remains unknown. But the strategy was well conceived and successful across the board, until Kilgallen realized the deadly intent behind Ruby's actions. Second, Ruby's explanation that he just happened by the jail entrance on the morning of the 24th fell apart. From Mr. Hallmark's testimony, Kilgallen now knew that Ruby was monitoring the Oswald transfer with whomever he spoke to on the parking lot phone. And, Kilgallen knew, Ruby telling the caller he would be there confirmed that Ruby had already made plans to be at the jail basement entrance the next day when Oswald's transfer would take place. This testimony must have made her realize that any semblance of truth regarding Ruby's story that he went to the Western Union office, left, and just happened to walk by the jail entrance at the exact time Oswald was being transferred was pure bunk. Ruby's use of these four explosive words, "he would be there," as recalled by a credible primary source witness, must not be underestimated. Kilgallen had to have recognized their importance, but sadly, other reporters apparently did not. History became truly distorted when apparently no one but Kilgallen paid close attention to the Ruby trial testimony or, if they did, was too frightened to publish it. Testimony never publicly circulated because Kilgallen died before her Random House book could be completed and published. Similarly, questions arise as to whether the jurors who were deciding Ruby's fate also missed the critical nature of Hallmark's testimony. In the aforementioned diary kept by juror Wayman Rose, 51 pages in length, he never mentions Hallmark's account of Ruby's phone call. Instead, Rose focuses on the confusing nature of the psychological testimony presented about Ruby's mental state. In addition, in his book, The Jack Ruby Trial Revisited, jury foreman Max Causey does not include any of Hallmark's testimony about Ruby having stated he would be at the Oswald transfer. In fact, he only mentions Hallmark's critical testimony on one page, page 62, out of 202 pages, recalling that Hallmark said Ruby was a preoccupied and intense person, and that Hallmark sometimes wondered about Jack's sanity. J. Edgar Hoover's Oswald Alone proclamation to the world brainwashed the public and journalists and authors at the time, and for decades to follow, with the prominent exception of Kilgallen. By mistakenly and suspiciously focusing exclusively on Oswald, Hoover also prejudiced the jury and reduced the trial to the task of deciding Ruby's punishment rather than exposing his motives and possible connections with the JFK assassination. Ignoring Hallmark's testimony about Ruby's statement, according to at least two of the jurors' accounts, confirms that Hoover had achieved his goal, and thus obstructed justice, not only in relation to Ruby, but also in regard to Oswald and, ultimately, the President of the United States. When Detective J.R. Lavelle testified, Kilgallen paid close attention to the details of the actual shooting of Oswald by Ruby. With great detail, the detective summarized how Ruby had stepped forward, gun in hand, and shot JFK's alleged assassin. While the testimony was mesmerizing at times, it would not have piqued the skilled reporter's interest, since she was now more interested in Ruby's activities as portrayed by the witnesses who had already testified. This said, she would have found one piece of evidence compelling: testimony relating to what the detective swore Ruby said shortly after shooting Oswald. Ruby's caustic comment, "I hope the son of a bitch dies," could have been interpreted several ways, but Kilgallen, in all likelihood, believed Oswald's killer hoped his intended prey would die so that his job would be complete. One may recall Detective Don Ray Archer's later account of his belief that Ruby was relieved. I would say his life had depended on his getting Oswald when he knew Oswald was dead. Archer did not provide that account at the Ruby trial, perhaps because he was not asked the right question, but his later statement made sense, since if Ruby had only wounded Oswald, it could have triggered repercussions from anyone who had ordered Ruby to kill Oswald. Kilgallen would have noted the significance of Detective Archer's testimony regarding Ruby's statement, "You all know me, I'm Jack Ruby," not only in that it confirmed a friendship with the Dallas police officers, but apparently many of them, since he said, "You all know me," not just, "You know me." Regarding the two Ruby statements, "I hope I killed the son of a bitch," and "I intended to shoot him 3 times, the former may have appeared to ring true when Kilgallen reviewed it, but the latter, perhaps, seemed out of line, that Ruby would say he wanted to shoot Oswald 3 times. Why 3? She might have wondered. Why 3? Common sense dictates that Kilgallen may have been puzzled by so many different versions of what Ruby allegedly said after he shot Oswald. It appeared to be overkill, especially quotes such as, "You rat son of a bitch," which sounded like bad movie dialogue. It must have made her wonder who was really telling the truth or exaggerating what they had heard, or if they were seeking their 15 minutes of fame and actually heard nothing at all. This cross-examination of McMillan by Melvin Belli confirmed once again Ruby's plan to act like a reporter so as to gain access to the jail entrance. Though Ruby states, "Y'all won't believe this, but I didn't have this planned," the admission that he could just act like a reporter rings true based on his behavior during the days leading up to his assassination of Oswald. Kilgallen very likely followed up on this testimony, perhaps with Belli, since the "act like a reporter" statement, if believed by the jury, was one more hole in his story about just accidentally being at the jail entrance when Oswald was being transferred. Pryor then discussed Ruby reappearing at the Dallas Morning News offices later on the 22nd after JFK was assassinated. Pryor's account permits the opportunity to indicate one instance, perhaps above all the others, where a Kilgallen column exactly mirrored testimony at the Ruby trial. On August 19, 1964, well after the Ruby trial, she wrote a Journal American column including the following words: "I find it hard to reconcile the picture of Jack Ruby performing on a twist board less than 24 hours after the president's assassination with the bereaved figure of a man who says he walked around in a state of emotional shock." Notice Kilgallen uses the word "performing on a twist board" instead of his trying to promote the twist board. Since she was right there in the courtroom, she must have heard the word "performing." Ruby's appearance at the newspaper office at exactly the time of JFK's assassination, combined with the twist board incident, must have prompted one of the most cunning reporters in the world to have strong suspicions that Ruby knew about the planned shootings before they occurred. If he was so distraught over JFK's death, as he told police and media after killing Oswald, then why, she had to have wondered, did his behavior lack the signs of being distraught so soon after the assassination? And if Ruby had lied about his sentiments toward the assassination of the president, then he must, she would have concluded, had other motives for showing up at the newspaper offices at the exact time of the president's killing. For Kilgallen, the whole time Ruby spent at the offices was simply too pat for her to believe. In all likelihood, she concluded, Ruby intended to be at those offices at a time calculated to enable him to look down the street toward Dealey Plaza instead of merely taking out ads for his nightclub. The alarming admission by DPD officer Don Ray Archer, previously mentioned, would have added to Kilgallen's suspicions if she had known about it. Recall that Jack Ruby had asked Archer if Oswald was dead. Recalling the conversation, Archer said, Rudy's behavior to begin with was very hyper. He was sweating profusely. I could see his heart beating. He asked me for one of my cigarettes. I gave him a cigarette. Finally, after about 2 hours had elapsed, the head of the Secret Service came up and I conferred with him, and he told me that Oswald had died. This should have shocked Ruby because it would mean the death penalty. I returned and said, Jack, it looks like it's going to be the electric chair for you. Instead of being shocked, he became calm. He quit sweating. His heart slowed down. I asked him if he wanted a cigarette, and he advised me that he didn't smoke. I was just astonished at this complete difference of behavior from what I had expected. I would say his life had depended on him getting Oswald. That Kilgallen's column echoed the trial testimony accurately and confirms not only her savvy grasp of the facts, but also her undaunted spirit as a journalist regarding what she wrote, points to her accuracy as a truth-seeking reporter and is a sure tribute to her integrity. And the last line of Archer's account cements the fact that her believing there was a plot to kill JFK was right on point. In addition to the evidence presented by eyewitnesses, considerable medical testimony consumed several days of the trial. Much of it was deeply technical, with sophisticated medical terms flying through the courtroom. The out-of-control egos of both the defense and prosecution teams regarding the defense claim that Ruby suffered from psychomotor epilepsy insanity and thus should be spared legal responsibility for the cold-blooded assassination of Oswald, resulted in a flood of testimony confusing the jurors. Experts brought to court by both sides appeared to cancel each other out, but there were witnesses toward the end of the trial who must have swayed the jurors to decide Ruby's actions could not be excused due to any sort of insanity. Kilgallen doubtless took extensive notes when these witnesses expressed their professional opinions. Defense counsel attempted to combat this explosive testimony with cross-examination. However, the testimony of Dr. Frederick Gibbs, a noted Chicago neurologist, backfired on the defense when he said, I have no opinion about whether Ruby knew right from wrong. But if one witness made the difference, it was arguably Dr. Stubblefield. He was a local resident whom the jurors felt they could trust. From that point on, it is safe to say the jury was going to convict Ruby of murder in the first degree. But Ruby, seemingly oblivious to Belly's incompetent defense, couldn't see it coming. Surveying the enormous amount of testimony Kilgallen digested during the long trial reveals the foundation for all of her columns and articles, as well as the basis for the investigation she conducted after the trial. Sitting in the front row, the reporter, who knew as much about the law as most lawyers, added note after note to her investigation file. When the trial was over and Ruby had been sentenced to the electric chair to die, she ramped up her efforts to discover the truth about who had killed her friend JFK and why. That Kilgallen paid close attention to every detail of the testimony is confirmed. Why? Because she wrote about what might have appeared as a small matter to the other reporters covering the trial, but to her was an item that simply did not make sense. The fact that it involved a twist board, Recall that Ruby, supposedly so distraught after JFK's death, attempted to sell this item to Dallas Morning News employees shortly after the assassination, may seem ridiculous to some, but Kilgallen, as sharp as any trial lawyer who ever lived, knew if Ruby lied about his shaky emotional state triggering his murder of Oswald, he had lied about much more. Kilgallen was not at all surprised when Ruby's plea of insanity was rejected and he was found guilty of murder with malice and sentenced to death. Obviously, she knew, his actions were not that of an insane man, but those of a man on a mission to eliminate Lee Harvey Oswald. As a result of her expert comprehension of the trial testimony, Kilgallen increased the danger to her life because her enemies knew, based on her newspaper columns, that she had learned that Ruby was part of a plot to kill JFK. Kilgallen also knew that the testimony confirming that Dallas police officers had helped Ruby enter the DPD basement was valid. In her column, she wrote, "Many New York variety acts who worked in nightclubs operated by Jack Ruby in Dallas say they weren't a bit surprised at the revelation that Ruby and the local police were chummy. So chummy, he was allowed to hang around headquarters while they were questioning Lee Harvey Oswald about the assassination of President Kennedy." The performers vividly recalled jam sessions at the Carousel where Dallas cops joined in the fun, some playing musical instruments, others doing turns as singers and comedians. They reported that the town's gendarmes made Rudy's nightclub their late-night hangout, enjoying parties with the strippers and his pals long after the official closing times. Deputy Sheriff and jailer Al Maddox further confirmed Ruby's close friendship with Dallas police when he told this author, "I used to go in there. Ruby comped all the police. They all owed him." Without question, Dorothy Kilgallen was indeed the reporter who knew too much based on the gathering of the most important evidence about John F. Kennedy's assassination. And yet, when she died, no one gave a damn, and she was buried without any proper and thorough investigation. As will be learned, like her kindred spirit and partner in fate, Marilyn Monroe, Kilgallen had been denied justice.